With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, information on incentive programs that help Central Valley growers with cover cropping. But we start today with this report from Cindy Zimmerman.
We are here at the conclusion of the American Coalition for Ethanol's annual fly-in in Washington, D.C. I'm with CEO Brian Jennings. Brian, how do you think it went?
I think it went well, Cindy. This was not our biggest fly-in in terms of participants, but so many time-sensitive issues. And you certainly saw the passion and the commitment and the dedication from the people that were here from around the country to help us push on those priority issues. And so I'm really pleased with it.
Well, we did have some, you know, missing lawmakers here, but it was great to see Deb Fischer take time out yesterday to come and speak with you, right?
Yeah, Senator Fischer of Nebraska, the lead sponsor on probably the most important piece of legislation for our industry right now pending in Congress, would permanently allow E15 nationwide. Of course, we're happy about having eight states with E15, but not so happy that we have to wait until 2025 for that. And we really ultimately need Senator Fischer's legislation to get over the finish line. And so the fact that we could meet with the primary author, she could help explain to us the roadblocks that she sees in the path of her legislation. And then we could have our members go to Capitol Hill and try to help sort of remove or overcome those roadblocks. That's what this event is all about.
Well, we are 2 weeks now past March 1st, and we were still supposed to get those GREET model changes 2 weeks ago. It's supposed to be weeks, not months. What have you heard while you've been here that gives you encouragement that's going to happen?
Yeah, we don't have a real solid idea of timing. Yesterday, as you know, Rod Snyder of EPA reiterated weeks, not months. We're going down to USDA to do some further meetings, and maybe we'll learn more on that front later today. But here's what I'm going to do until I have a reason not to. I'm going to take Secretary Vilsack for his word that they do want to get the details right. It is true that the GREET model is complex. We do our darndest to try to simplify this when we talk to members of Congress, but this is a complex model, and life cycle greenhouse gas emissions is a complex topic. And so you introduce climate smart agriculture and what sort of value certain practices should get in the GREET model. This gets difficult, and we need it to be done right. So we're going to keep pressing on them. Yes, to get the guidance out, because if you're potentially producing sustainable aviation fuel, that tax credit expires at the end of this year, and then it sort of becomes part of a new tax credit. But yeah, folks that are really seriously looking at this, this is troublesome for them when they don't know whether they could qualify for a tax credit.
We have a presidential election this year. Is anything going to get done this year, do you think?
It's funny. We heard from some of our teams that went up to Capitol Hill yesterday that the opinion was probably not much is going to get done, and that's often true in an election year. And you know, you've got tight control in the House and the Senate as well. So you know, Republicans on the House side, Democrats on the Senate side. So it wouldn't shock me. But you know, there was also some feedback that maybe in a lame duck we could move something like an E15 bill. And I think that's probably what this ultimately boils down to, is building momentum for the legislation that we really would like to see, and then letting the chips fall where they may relative to November. I think things could look very different out here, frankly, you know, after the election, in terms of what Congress and the White House look like, but some opportunities to maybe move something after the election.
But that's no reason for ethanol producers and stakeholders to not keep the pressure on, right?
No, in fact, if we fail to do the work between now and November, we won't have an opportunity to move anything in the lame duck. So it's all about sort of creating momentum, getting more co-sponsors for E15 bills or the Next Generation Fuels Act, and putting your champions in Congress in a position to help get you across the finish line when that opportunity arises. So no, we can't lay back and just sort of ignore what's going on in Washington. In fact, we have to sort of redouble our efforts.
Anything else you want to add, Brian?
No, thanks for being here again.
All right, thank you very much. Here at the ACE DC Fly-In, I'm Cindy Zimmerman.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, what's putting a damper on free trade agreement efforts? Gary Crawford looks into it.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack sometimes faces criticism from lawmakers who complain that the administration is not negotiating free trade agreements with trading partners around the world.
They send me letters about this all the time. They say, Secretary, we need free trade agreements.
But Vilsack told this week's AgriPulse Food Policy Summit that in order to have meaningful free trade negotiations, Congress needs to pass a Trade Promotion Authority bill, so-called Fast Track, which would limit action by Congress to just an up-and-down vote on any agreement. Without that Fast Track process in place,
it means that 535 members of the House and the Senate can amend any trade agreement you negotiate. Now, folks, put yourself in that position. Let's say I'm negotiating with you. And you know that the deal I make with you isn't the final deal because 535 people could amend it. What kind of deal are you going to make with me?
Probably, Vilsack says, not a very good one or no agreement at all. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
USDA recently announced funding awards associated with its Agricultural Conservation Easement Program as means to conserve various farm and watershed easements. Rod Bain reports.
Another round of investments focused on conserving and improving farmland, grassland, and wetland easements. The announcement from Agriculture Department Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation, Robert Bonney.
$138 million goes into our Agricultural Conservation Easement Program. And this will support about 138 individual easements across the country.
The Natural Resources Conservation Service oversees ASEP projects in two components: agricultural land easements,
farmlands or ranch lands that are impacted by suburban development, or maybe there are threats to turn it into non-agricultural use or non-grasslands in the case of grasslands. And so in those cases, we're providing funding to keep those lands in agriculture, to provide an incentive for those lands to they'll stay in agriculture forever.
And wetland reserve easements.
So these are either grasslands or a lot of times forest lands. We're restoring the wetland features on those. They can continue to be working farms and ranches and forest lands. But we're doing things that's going to protect those wetlands, protect water quality, protect habitat, and then importantly, keep those lands in private ownership.
As acreage, particularly prime ag production land and wildlife habitat, is lost to development, programs like ASEP
helps keep those family farms and families by purchasing the development rights, basically purchasing from landowners the ability to develop. So it's an incentive for them to keep those lands in agriculture. And it's a way that we can balance both agriculture, conservation, and the needs of those families.
The undersecretary adds more ASEP-oriented resources are expected to be allocated this year.
So what producers can do if they're interested in is, one is to go into your local MRCS office and talk to the folks there. There are also a lot of land trusts that we partner with. Sometimes it's a state land trust or a state Department of Agriculture, or it's a local land trust, a local land conservancy organization that helps landowners enroll in these programs.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with the Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, beef on dairy. It's a profitable option for dairy farmers if they do it the correct way. That's according to Blake Foraker, Washington State University Assistant Professor of Meat Science.
The producers need to be mindful, particularly here as we talk about low beef cow numbers. The supply of these calves from the dairy industry is as important now as it's ever been. We've got to get beef on dairy right at this time.
Foraker says traits are important when it comes to selecting animals.
If you're not selecting in this terminal crossbreeding system for the right kinds of traits that can optimize value in the beef supply chain, essentially what we've done is created just a black-hided Holstein that's really not any more profitable than its counterpart that we were producing 10 years ago when beef on dairy wasn't occurring on such a wide-scale basis.
So what traits should a producer be looking for?
There's lots of traits that are important here, and those specifically pertain to carcass muscularity and conformation. We understand that dairy does very positively contribute to the ever-important marbling traits that are so highly valued in the beef supply chain, but muscularity is no doubt deficient, and so that's something that producers should be mindful of. In addition to some other things, growth is obviously a really important one as well.
Feed efficiency, he says, is key.
Dairy animals haven't been bred for optimization in the beef supply chain, and so by and large, feed efficiency and average daily gain is generally poor from these dairy-influenced populations. However, we've got the data that demonstrate that when selected properly, beef on dairy calves can be just as efficient and gain just as well as conventional beef cattle when fed appropriately.
For dairy farmers interested in the beef on dairy, he says they should find resources to help guide them through the process. In other livestock news, another look at the forecast for milk production, product demand, and prices for this year. Rod Bain reports.
What might 2024 have in store for dairy producers? Agriculture Department dairy analyst Michael McCottle offered an outlook for the dairy sector at this year's USDA Ag Outlook Forum.
Overall, we see milk production projected to continue growing, but at a decreasing rate from what we've seen in recent years. Feed prices are projected to be lower in the upcoming year, but we're expecting tighter global markets for dairy products, which are going to provide price support.
Specifically, strong demand for dairy products here and abroad.
We're projecting higher exports, particularly on a FAB basis. While domestic use on skim solids basis is lower year over year, it's also worth noting that at over 180 billion pounds, it remains at a relatively elevated level relative to what we've seen in the past 5 years or so. So overall, demand both domestic and for exports we're expecting to be relatively robust in the upcoming year.
In terms of how this translates into projected milk category and class prices for 2024,
we're forecasting prices coming off of the recent lows that we saw in 2023 and increasing a bit. However, they're not quite as high as the highest prices we've seen in the past 3 years.
So the breakdown of the forecast for this year's milk product prices include
butter and non-fat dry milk. Butter not projecting prices to spike quite as high as all the past couple of years, but still pretty strong seasonal movement in the butter price. And NDM, a steady increase and improvement from previous year. Cheese is the one dairy product we're actually expecting year over year prices to be lower. We're expecting the price to come up a bit from the recent lows that we've seen in the past couple months.
And with stronger prices expected across milk products,
we're expecting class prices to be higher year over year as well. We expect the class 4 price to remain higher than the class 3. The value of butter and NDM continue to be relatively higher than the historical standards compared to cheese and whey.
With 2024's all milk price expected to be up 43 cents from the previous year at $20.95 per hundredweight. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
I'm Will Jordan for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
Incentive programs are a vital component for enabling farmers to implement new production approaches in their operation. Vice President of Matoyan Brothers LLC, Richard Matoyan, said they're having success with some new incentive opportunities for composting and cover crops from NRCS that they were able to take advantage of.
So I knew, first of all, that we needed to do a pre-irrigation prior to planting. We have sandy loam soil here. Unfortunately, our irrigation district still had water available, irrigated the ground with flood water at the end of October, and then about a week later planted the cover crop, put about 45 pounds per acre in the row. We planted about at the 11 to 12 foot swath in the rows, and within about 10 days the cover crop started peeking through the soil, and since then it's just been rain fed, and fortunately we've had enough rain to keep it going.
Certis Biologicals and SDS Biotech have formed a strategic alliance to develop and commercialize biological crop protection solutions. The collaboration leverages SDS Biotech's experience in research and development with Certis's proficiency in commercializing biocontrol products. Both companies aim to accelerate the delivery of biological solutions to farmers worldwide, enhancing crop protection and yields. Certis Biologicals expanded its research facilities in California and Maryland, while SDS Biotech strengthened its focus on research and development following a merger. New equipment, technology, and personnel increases the capacity for evaluating product performance and generating new formulations. The partnership underscores a commitment to creating efficient, effective, and sustainable products for growers, aligning with initiatives to grow the biologicals market. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is investing approximately $138 million from the Inflation Reduction Act into 138 new climate-smart conservation easements. These easements, as part of the Agricultural Conservation Easement Program, aim to conserve wetlands, grasslands, and prime farmlands supporting climate-smart agriculture and forestry initiatives. The USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service prioritizes land that reduces, captures, avoids, or sequesters carbon dioxide, methane, or nitrous oxide emissions. These efforts follow streamlining initiatives within NRCS to simplify ASEP processes. Overall, the Inflation Reduction Act allocates $19.5 billion in additional funding for climate-smart agriculture and forestry activities, with ASEP receiving $1.4 billion over several years. Growers dealing with Ascochyta leaf blight in garbanzo bean fields have several mitigation options. Agronomy and Nutrient Management Advisor Nick Clark described what kind of issue the disease can be and highlighted potential approaches for management.
This fungus infects the plant tissue and then it generates spores on the outside of the plant. And when rain comes, it splashes down on there and the little tiny splashes from the raindrops carry the spores onto other parts of the plant or neighboring plants. So that it can start more infections and it spreads that way. If there's an infection in season or people notice this disease developing in their field, there are some foliar fungicides that can be applied. We have azoxystrobin, boscalid, and pyroclostrobin that are registered for use in California garbanzos to control infection of Ascochyta leaf blight. One important thing to note is using foliar fungicides to control Ascochyta leaf blight doesn't roll back the clock on infection and disease that's already happened. It only works to help prevent new infection and new development of disease. It can require retreatment in the season as maybe allowed on the label as needed by the, you know, how much disease is developing in the field and whether or not the forecasted weather conditions are likely to promote more disease development, such as rain.
The Western Cover Crops Council and UC Cooperative Extension are hosting a cover crop field day and open farm tour next week. The event is scheduled for Tuesday, March 26th at Park Farming Organics in Meridian, beginning at 9 a.m. Cooperative Extension Agronomy Farm Advisor Sarah Light will be giving a research update on cover crop field trials in annual rotations in the Sacramento Valley. Manager of the Lockford Plant Materials Center, Margaret Smither-Caperl, will also be discussing soil biodiversity and soil health indicators. The open house and farm tour will feature a discussion and demonstration of equipment, what types of considerations are needed for cover crop management and regenerative agriculture, and the pros and cons of cover cropping in wet and dry years. More information on the field day is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
The Agriculture Department supports developments of our nation's biomanufacturing sector. Rod Bain tells us how in today's This Land of Ours report.
Biomanufacturing is a growing industry. Products ranging from farm lubricants to playground equipment, packaging and apparel. USDA, through its Rural Development Mission Area and Rural Business Cooperative Service, are among the entities serving as incubators and investors into this sector. As RBCS Administrator Betsy Dirksen-Londergan told an audience at this year's AgriPulse Ag and Food Summit,
we provide grants and loans to rural businesses. We do that directly. We do it through banks. We also do it through cooperatives.
And based on a recent USDA report on developing a more resilient supply chain for biomass feedstocks and goods produced from them,
do we have enough biomass to support the industries of the future? And the answer is yes. And those opportunities are all over rural America.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back. For this segment, we go to Cindy Zimmerman once again.
I'm here at the Ace Fly-In, and I'm with Bill Kauser, my friend from Iowa, who's a cattle producer and an ethanol plant investor, and also a member of the EPA Farm, Ranch, and Rural Communities Advisory Committee, and something he's been on before and been on for a while. So, Bill, tell us about that committee and your involvement in it.
Yeah, they reenacted it about 6 years ago, and they put out to the United States, they wanted people to put in their application and kind of a broad base across the country of livestock producers and different academia. And out of 560 applications, I was very blessed to be one of the 30 to become on and be able to represent the farming community, the ethanol community, agriculture, basically. And what our job is to do is we basically get three or four challenges every year from the administrator. And our job is to come together with a white paper. Is how can EPA improve their methods of reaching out to rural America, to the cities of America, whether it's wastewater, whether it's manure issues, whether it's methane, and how do we make sure that the administration hears from grassroots?
Well, you've worked with several different EPA administrators. What do you think about our current administrator?
Well, as I stated in the meeting here, we had the privilege of hosting Regan and Vilsack the first week on the job here 3.5 years ago in our shop. And like I stated, it's the first time I've seen in my career of 30 or 40 years coming in here of those two gentlemen from different offices in the same room at the same time, because we would always get their staff. And to see the relationship now that EPA and USDA have and can sit down together, not their staff, but the two leaders, and come to an agreement where everybody can work through some of the issues and policies that we've got going on. And then to be part of the farming community or the agriculture community and bring a recommendation to both of those gentlemen, because, you know, I know them both personally. It means something, and they've always got someone they can call.
Well, you also spend a lot of time here up in D.C. You're here for the ASTC fly-in. You're here almost every year, as far as I know. And you also come up here with other groups. So just tell me about your experience this year and some of the meetings that you had and how they went.
Well, you know, I can honestly say I've been doing this for 30 years, and in the last 10 years, we finally have a seat at the table. You know, as a livestock producer, when I put on my cattle cap, you know, the EPA was a bad word. I mean, we would never let them in. And another gentleman, Dave Petty from Iowa, and I decided 20 years ago we were going to change that relationship. So now we've cultivated it to where we have those positions. I have three appointments in EPA now, and we've actually held meetings in the National Cattlemen's Office with EPA, which you would have never heard of 10 years ago. So we feel very strongly that we've cultivated a relationship because they're part of our team now, and we can't forget that. Whether you're ethanol, whether you're agriculture, whatever it is, they're part of your team because it's part of the policy, it's part of the rulemaking, and as a feedlot operator, I have an NPDES permit. So I have rules and regulations I have to follow, and the reason I'm so adamant, I think I'm in here every month for the next 7 months to do something with EPA or USDA, is I want to make sure that my sons, or our sons and daughters, can farm in the future with policy they can survive with.
Well, as far as the issues facing the ethanol industry right now, year-round E15, getting the GREET model right for SAF, those kinds of things, that's what we talked about on the Hill this week. What do you think the chances are that any of that is going to get done in this presidential election year?
Well, I don't know if we'll see it done in this presidential election year. I think everyone, when you go to the Hill, it's a different mindset today. And it's challenging, but we heard positive messages from the D's and from both sides of the aisle. And they all want to get it done. They want to get a farm bill done. They want to get E15. But it's going a little bit slower, I think, on the EPA side because they want to make sure that this is done right and they get sued less. You know, I think that's one of the challenges because everybody's not afraid to sue today. And so if it does take us another year, it might have to be. But we're going to continue to say, let's get it signed because we got to do it eventually. We've smoothed all the rough edges over for whether, you know, on our Hill visits, whether Democrat or Republican. Everybody's in agreement because if you're involved in climate or believe in climate, we're part of the solution. And that's what this administration is driven for. So the big man says, we're doing this. Let's get it done. And I think that's the other thing. I think it's something we need to understand. We will always respect the office of the president, no matter who, because it's our job to decide who's there. And who's ever there, that's fine. But we've learned over the years, we're going to put ourselves close to the career people because they're going to be here the next time I come to D.C.
That's a very good point. That's all the questions I have, Bill. Anything else you want to add?
Well, I just want to thank agriculture for allowing us to be in here, and I want to make sure that everyone, you know, you have the opportunity to come in here and hear your voice.
All right. Thanks very much. Bill Kowser here in Washington, D.C. with the Ace Fly, and I'm Cindy Zimmerman.
There's a special bunny that certainly gets things hopping this time of year. Some may not believe in him, but let's not split hairs. Gary Crawford reports.
Well, it's that time of year again when we begin to expect a visit from that famous bunny.
It's Easter Rabbit, hooray!
No, Bugs, don't even go there, please.
Tooey, I'm glad I don't have to do this for a living.
I don't think Bugs, it symbolizes the things that the Easter Bunny was intended to symbolize.
That's Anne Eflin, historical expert with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So what has a bunny really got to do with Easter anyway? Where did all that get started? Well, actually, Easter was around centuries before Christ.
Originally, it was a holiday that celebrated a Germanic goddess, the Saxon goddess Esther, or Easter.
E-A-S-T-R-E, Easter.
And she was the goddess of spring and fertility, and that, of course, is how she's associated with a springtime celebration.
And the early Christian church took that celebration and attached to it the observation of the resurrection of Christ, which did help convert many pagans of that day to Christianity. But it came at springtime, a time of new life and fertility, and that brings us to...
Well, here's the joyous bunny's voice stop. Here's the Easter Rabbit, hooray! And a happy Easter Rabbit. Here, kid, have an egg.
The rabbit is, an ancient traditional symbol of fertility and was also actually the symbol of the goddess Easter.
She was often pictured in early German culture as at least part rabbit, but the bunny soon took on a life of its own, doing things we expect of him today. And again, it was first in Germany, first mentioned in any records in the 1500s.
And it came to the United States by way of the Pennsylvania Dutch, or the Pennsylvania German settlers who came to the U.S. And the tradition in Germany is that German children expect a visit from Osterhaus, who is the Easter rabbit, on Easter Eve, who will lay a nest of eggs for good children. And in the U.S. tradition, children would hide their hats in places around the home, in the barns, in the gardens, and that the Easter Bunny would find those and lay eggs in them.
And there you have the beginnings, sort of in reverse, of the Easter egg hunt and some of our modern traditions. But Bugs Bunny, I really have to agree with Anne Eflin. Having you as the Easter Bunny just does not do it for us.
Well, that's that. No more finagling with Easter eggs. He's Easter Bunny.
Oh, there he goes again. So if you find carrots in your Easter basket this year, you'll know why. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington.
This is the AgNet NewsHour, and we'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. For today's featured interview, I'm talking with USDA Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs, Ginny Lester Moffitt. We're discussing a few USDA programs.
There are a couple of programs to talk about this morning, and I was wondering if we could start out with the organics.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, Sabrina, it's great to talk with you today and talk with you about the three programs that we're here to talk about today, Building Ag Prosperity in Rural America. So as you said, the organic program, this is an organic market development grant program. We know how much of a consumer demand there is for organic products and how large of a market this is growing. It's an opportunity for producers to be able to capture a price premium. It's a market that's now at about 4% of the overall food market, which has grown significantly from where it was just a few decades ago at 1%. The Organic Market Development Program, we announced 70 projects that have received funding with over $61 million in investments. It's about supporting the development expansion of new and existing organic markets to increase the consumption. In Michigan, interestingly, one of the projects that we've invested in is Almar Orchards in Michigan, that is an organic apple orchard. They're able, through this grant program, to be able to purchase and install a washing and sorting line that's actually going to allow them to be able to partner and grow into the organic and baby and kid food market sector, which is an important market sector for organics. It allows them not only to expand their own organic production, but also to be able to expand production for other apple producers in the state to become organic. Again, it's about tapping this new market opportunity there in Michigan, but of course to grow organic production around the nation as well.
And, you know, you mentioned how important organics have become and how the market is growing. Do you expect to see the continued growth?
Yeah, it certainly is a growing sector. This program is really designed to increase domestic production. We know consumers are demanding more and more organic production, and we want to make sure that our producers here in the United States get to tap into this important value-added market. Just through this program alone, through the 70 projects and the $61.5 million we've invested, we know that more than 27,000 organic producers are going to benefit from these investments. And also more than 30 million consumers will be able to benefit from it. So really strong investments to be able to grow things like organic, of course, like apple production, but also things like livestock feed and dairy and fibers, and other organic ingredients that are not currently now available in the market, again, to even grow the market sector even more.
You mentioned a project in Michigan, and I was wondering if you had any other examples, maybe out west, the California area or southeast areas. I know that that's, you know, springing it kind of on you when you weren't prepared, but do you have any other examples available?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's several projects, of course, in the California area. And we met with one producer last week, the organic rice producer, to be able to expand organic rice production in the state in California so that rice producers can diversify into organic markets. I was out in Colorado meeting with some grain producers who have formed the Colorado Grain Chain. And it is about linking, hence the chain name, linking producers with local buyers for organic grains that are bring more value and diverse opportunities for producers. And then in the Southeast, we funded several different projects. One was the Georgia Organic Peanut Association, for them to be able to expand into organic, you know, oil markets as well, which is really important in processing, because we all know that there is, of course, the primary processing of the product like peanuts that gets to markets, but then being able to do the secondary processing of oil products adds value and really makes the difference between being able to break even and break a profit.
Fantastic. So let's talk about a couple of the other programs. The Resilient Food Systems Infrastructure Program. Give me an overview of what this is and why it's important.
Yeah. So the Resilient Food System Infrastructure Program is a partnership that USDA has with state and territory departments of agriculture. So the program is run through the states and their Department of Agriculture, and the funding comes from USDA. And it's very much a strong partnership. The goal of the program is to fund the things like aggregation, processing, transportation, distribution of products that are not in the meat and poultry sector, because we have a separate program for that. This is about things like investing in cold storage for produce, or freezing and drying capacity to be able to extend the market availability and extend the reach that a farmer might be able to have into different markets. It's about expanding local and regional distribution and what we call aggregation, right? And so that is really about the place where farmers can bring their product to a local distributor, a regional distributor, and then those distributors can then transport the product to important new markets for producers, like schools, like hospitals, to be able to also tap into and expand into restaurant and grocery markets as well. This is about giving more choices in the marketplace, giving more opportunities and avenues for producers to get their product direct from farm to different sectors of the market. So consumers have more choice in the marketplace, but also producers have and see and can tap into the value stream of add value. And that's really important for the work that we're doing. It gets down to the crux of what we're really focused on, which is about increasing diversity in streams of income that farmers and ranchers have, so that family farmers so that small and mid-sized producers see the opportunity and are able to tap into the prosperity alignment that we absolutely need for, of course, rural prosperity, but also for a reliable food supply.
Yeah, and a program like this has a lot of benefits, for, like you said, for the agricultural sector. But then, you know, so many of our listeners are also, you know, rural residents. So how does this help, you know, just people like them, maybe who are not involved in farming, but who do live in rural areas?
Yeah, it gives more choices in the marketplace. It gives more choices for consumers to be able to buy from producers in their region, more opportunity to shop, knowing that their purchases are supporting local economies. Many of these projects, as we look at them and as we're investing in them, are also adding new jobs as they increase the processing or the distribution that they're doing. And so more jobs in rural communities is a really important piece of this as well.
Great. And then before we run out of time, tell me a little bit about the Local Meat Capacity Grant.
Yeah, absolutely. So we for so many of your listeners, and I've heard this from so many producers, I experienced it in the work that I was doing at the beginning of the pandemic. We saw what happened when we had a disruption in the supply chain, when the meat processors weren't able to process at the capacity they had been. And meat producers who had ranchers and farmers who had been producing producing their cattle and their poultry and their swine products lost a place to bring their product to market, lost their processing opportunities. So this program is really about expanding market opportunities, expanding places where and investing in the critical processing infrastructure that we need across the nation so that farmers and ranchers are more competitive in the food system and the meat and poultry processing. So it can be everything from, of course, all of the processing equipment to packaging, to sausage grinders, to smokehouses, all of the critical things that are needed so that meat lockers and custom processors and meat and regional meat processing plants can be able to grow and thrive and sustain the really important fabric that we have across the nation of meat producers.
So for this grant, and then also the organic market development grants, are these the available now? Is it something that will be coming up soon in the future?
So the organic market development grant program, we've already received the applications. And so at this point, we are reviewing the applications that have already been received. So there's at this point, no new funding that's available. For meat and poultry processing, the Local Meat Capacity Grant program is closed for applications. But USDA through Rural Development will have another grant program as well. And then the Resilient Food System Infrastructure is, again, it's administered state by state. So it really depends on where the state is in their application. Some states have already opened and closed their application period. Some states are currently have their application open, and some states have already will have them coming soon.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for your time. I know that you've got a busy schedule today, so I appreciate you spending a few minutes with us.
Thank you, Sabrina. It's a pleasure to join.
We'll be right back. You are listening to the AgNet News Hour. Now for more news. Farmers and ranchers from across the country descended on Capitol Hill this week to talk about labor challenges. Chad Smith has more on the decades-long push for a fix.
Farm Bureau members went to Capitol Hill to talk with their senators and representatives about a labor shortage that's reaching critical levels. Arizona farmer John Boltz says the current system of utilizing H-2A workers is no longer viable.
We've been short of workers for well over two decades, and over the last year or two, we've been watching the use of that explode. When we're seeing H-2A used that heavily, we're in crisis mode in U.S. agriculture. It's an expensive program to use. It's bureaucratically challenging, and it takes a reasonable manner of expertise to navigate the system and actually get workers.
He says the farmers went to Capitol Hill to advocate for two key changes.
We're back here asking particularly for a freeze in the adverse effect wage rate that's part of the H-2A program and asking for a suspension to the disaggregated worker pay rates that was introduced in 2023 so that more farms can stay in business because we've really gotten to that point where we're so desperate that farms are deciding to shut down.
Bolts is asking other farmers and ranchers to get involved in advocating for a labor fix. Learn more at fb.org/labor. Chad Smith, Washington.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.